we'll continue our discussion with CNN's diseases. Just a review, you remember the three layers of meninges? Neuromotor, arachnoid, femotor. The subarachnoid space is where the spinal fluid circulates. Total volume of spinal fluid for an adult is around 140 to 170, so that's why we can withdraw 20 milliliters without too much problem. But neonates, infants, don't have very much, 10 to 60. So we usually withdraw this depends on what they need, maybe 2 mils. And then just have to go from there as to what they can do with it. Okay, we talked about the function of the spinal fluid being to protect the brain, to cushion it, and to circulate the nutrients and the oxygen around. And then we talked about the blood-brain barrier, which is just actually the close fit of the epithelial cells, but it can be more permeable, it can be made more permeable through trauma, infection or sepsis, and inflammation. And that's important because in these inflammatory conditions, organisms can cross more readily and get into the brain. But also some of the drugs that we use can get in there more readily as well. Okay, let's go through diseases then, starting with acute meningitis. Okay, it's called acute because it has very rapid onset. And being meningitis, it's an inflammation of the meninges. The untreated mortality is very high, and that's why it's such a scary disease, because it comes on so quickly. The patient needs to seek medical attention immediately, or the parents usually in this case, because it's mostly in the children. And that's why they administer empiric treatment before they fully know what the organism is or what the condition is. And as long as the patient has symptoms, that's what they'll do. Let's go through some of the symptoms here. Subacute meningitis is probably the stage in which the majority of patients will seek help. So it's definitely much more common than is acute meningitis. So the symptoms, with acute meningitis, the symptoms occur probably within 24 hours, or the patient seeks help within 24 hours of the symptoms. With subacute meningitis, the symptoms can persist for up to a week before the patient seeks medical attention. So they're not quite as severe as with the acute, but the symptoms are very similar. So they can start out with a fever. In fact, they can start out with just symptoms like an upper respiratory tract infection initially. Fever is present, headache, stiff neck. And the technical term for stiff neck is mucorigidity. Have you heard that before? Mucorigidity. Okay. So there's a good term to use in your conversation today. Myalgia, we know what that is, right? What's myalgia? Muscle aches, pains, nausea, vomiting. And vomiting is usually what we call projectile vomiting. You know, from me to Bill. Photophobia is the light that bothers the people, very sensitive to light. Mentation changes. Okay, this is what can be very severe. It can range from lethargy. So I'd say you were probably all in the initial stages of subacute meningitis. Lethargy up to coma. And the patient can have it, if it's not diagnosed and treated, it continues, especially with acute meningitis. The patient can suffer some severe permanent hearing loss, blindness, learning deficits. So it can obviously affect the central nervous system for life, or for the rest of their life if it's not treated. Now, in some one particular case of meningitis, there is a rash. And it's a petechial rash. So what are petechiae? You know what those are now. Okay, so it's bleeding. So pinpoint hemorrhages that can spread to make larger areas. We mentioned when we first started talking about rashes back with skin diseases, you remember the types of rashes we described? Macule, papule, vesicle, pustule. And we included petechiae in there, petechial rash in there. And the reason is because if it's meningitis caused by Neisseria meningitidis, it will cause a petechial rash. So that's actual bleeding and not just the other types of rashes that we get in skin diseases.
So is it affecting your clotting mechanism?
I don't know what the exact mechanism is. Whether it's the clotting mechanism or whether it's destroying the membrane of capillaries, or I'm not sure what it is. Both acute and subacute meningitis can be bacterial or viral. Most of it's bacterial. 95% of meningitis occurs in children, so again, that's why it's particularly scary. Okay, so here's an example of the petechial rash that started very tiny and then obviously spread to include necrosis in the skin. So that's one thing the doc's going to look for as far as clinical signs and symptoms go, is that type of rash.
How far along would that be?
That's probably pretty far, I'd say. Yeah. Okay, then there's a chronic meningitis. Chronic meningitis. Bill's throwing things at me. Okay, chronic meningitis, the symptoms have persisted for longer than 4 weeks. So the symptoms are not, there's similar type symptoms, fever, headache, those kinds of things, but they're not as severe, so the patient does not seek medical attention. And tell the symptoms have probably been ongoing for a month or more. So very gradual onset. This is usually caused by those types of organisms that are more chronic in nature, like Mycobacterium tuberculosis. What's T. pallidum? What does T. stand for? Treponema. Yeah, treponema. Treponema pallidum. What does that cause?
Syphilis.
Yes. Syphilis. Okay, and that's important because later on when we talk about the sexually transmitted diseases, we'll come back and talk about this, but there's one of the stages, the tertiary stage of syphilis, which is neurosyphilis, that affects the brain and the central nervous system, would probably have similar type symptoms, so very gradual onset. That doesn't occur for 15, 20, 30 years or so. What's Borrelia burgdorferi? What does that cause?
Yellow
fever. Yellow fever is virus.
Rocky Mountain.
Not Rocky Mountain, spotted fever.
Keep going.
It's that lecture. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you all should know it.
All
these should all know.
All around. It's all
fine. Starts with an L.
Lyme disease.
Borrelia burgdorferi causes Lyme disease. And we'll talk about that when we get into the zoonoses. Okay, because it's transmitted by vectors. But it can lead, in serious cases, can lead to a chronic meningitis. So we can have fungi, you know, cryptococcuses now. Candida, that's a yeast. We'll talk about these later when we get to mycology, and viruses and parasites. So chronic meningitis can be caused by a variety of agents. And it's just a disease that certainly has its symptoms, but it just is ongoing for a long period of time. And is usually not fatal because it's not as severe. Okay, there's a category known as aseptic meningitis. What does the term aseptic mean?
No infectious agents.
We usually use aseptic, when we talk about aseptic technique, to mean being very clean and sterile and not transferring or contaminating things. In this case, it means culture negative, that you cannot culture the bacteria. So what that means is it's most likely viral in nature. You can't culture any bacteria. The patient still has the same type of symptoms. But viral meningitis or aseptic meningitis is usually not nearly as severe as bacterial meningitis. In fact, it's often self-limiting. It will cure itself within a period of time, a week or a couple weeks or so. So that means it's usually viral, but it can have non-infectious causes, which means a tumor going somewhere in there that upsets the barrier of the meninges, or hemorrhage in the brain somewhere can lead to meningitis-type symptoms. But that's what we say when we say aseptic meningitis is apparent culture or anything, so it's usually viral. Encephalitis, what did we say the definition of encephalitis was?
Brain.
Inflammation of the brain tissue and not the meninges, so somewhere else inside the brain parenchyma. And again, that can be acute or chronic. Symptoms resemble meningitis, so initially it may not be easy to differentiate whether it's meningitis or encephalitis, but they tend to go on and have additional symptoms like seizures and paralysis, which we don't see typically in meningitis. Mentation changes.
With our little cousin that got meningitis, she got lots of seizures.
And it's possible, you know, depending on how severe it is. Did they culture an agent?
Yeah, to beta strep.
Okay. So it's possible that you can get that, but hopefully, and that's why you want to seek medical attention early and treat it so that it doesn't progress to that point. But that's not saying that you're always going to prevent those changes from occurring. Those symptoms occurring. So this one, this virus is usually viral. I've listed a couple of the more common types of viruses, the tobovirus, equine, but there are other viruses that can cause it. Herpes can cause up to 20% of encephalitis. So why is that important? Herpes, are those that belong to the herpes family, are those that can live within the nerves, the peripheral nerves, as we talked about, they can travel along the peripheral nerves and eventually pop out. That's where you get the cold sores. That's where you get the genital herpes that we'll talk about later. But the problem here is that the baby contracts it from mom. So mom has a herpes infection in the vaginal tract. Baby is born and picks it up. Okay, brain abscess. This is, we know what an abscess is. It's an infection deeper within the tissues. So this is a closed infection in the brain. It causes swelling, and there isn't much room for the brain to swell. And that's one of the reasons where the symptoms come from. We're going to go through the pathogenesis of meningitis here in a minute. But this one we can't culture because it's a closed infection, abscess in the brain, somewhere in the tissue. It doesn't get into the spinal fluid. So if we do a spinal tap, we can't culture the organism. They're probably going to have maybe some of the same symptoms, but different symptoms as well. Major cause of brain abscess is an embolus, blood clot that travels to the brain and lodges there, and the organisms can proliferate. Okay, here's the supposed pathogenesis of meningitis, just the mechanism by which the bacteria, the infection, leads to the symptoms. Okay, so we start out with bacterial antigens. So whatever organism is causing the disease, the organism stimulates release of cytokines. So what are cytokines from immunology?
Calling people in. Yeah.
That's chemotaxis.
Calling people? We've got people inside our room.
And calling recruits.
Okay, those are chemicals. Chemicals that are released by the white blood cells. In this case, it's primarily interleukin-1, released from monocytes, that attracts other white blood cells.
People.
And that initiates an inflammatory response. The rubor, calor, tumor, dolor, you know, those classical symptoms of inflammation, but no education is complete without knowing those four symptoms. Okay. That leads to vasculitis, which is just more of an inflammation of the blood vessels, and eventually tissue necrosis. Then, because of all that involvement, we get edema, which is the swelling, fluid accumulation, swelling in the brain. And again, there isn't much area, much room there for the brain to swell. So it doesn't take a whole lot. Hypoxia, what's that?
Lack
of oxygen. So the vasculitis, the tissue necrosis, interferes with the circulation of the spinal fluid through that subarachnoid space, and that's what transports the oxygen, so we don't get adequate oxygen transportation throughout the brain. And along with the swelling, that leads to pressure. Intracranial pressure builds up, and eventually that impairs neurologic function.
So, you know how to do the spinal tap, you need to be below a certain amount of pressure?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it be hard to get the CSF from these types of people then?
Depends on how high the pressure is.
Okay.
Yeah. They have for adults, and I'm not sure what it is, maybe the same thing for children or infants, the pressure level is about 200 millimeters of mercury. And if it's above that, then you don't want to withdraw. If it's below that, you're probably safe to withdraw gradually so that you don't herniate or pull the membranes away from the brain structure. Okay, so that's kind of how it happens. So that's why if we catch it early and treat it and get rid of those bacteria before this whole process develops, then it's, we're a lot better off. But again, if you've got acute meningitis, it goes very quickly, and sometimes you can't. Okay, let's go through the organisms then according to age distribution. We looked at, on Monday, we looked at the chart that showed organisms and then their ages at which they occur, so we're going to look at it the opposite way this time. Neonates, which are considered less than 3 months in age, Haemophilus influenza type B. Again, that used to be the most common cause, not so much anymore because of the vaccination. The HIB vaccine, it's given at 2 months. Strep A galactia, that's what comes from mom. That can lead to the early onset or the late onset. Early onset would be within the first few days, and they usually have meningitis and they can have pneumonia, an upper respiratory or lower respiratory infection also. Or if it's late onset, they can still get meningitis from that. That's what comes from mom, so you can see why it's important then to culture mom before birth to see if she is a carrier and then administer antibiotics to prevent that transfer to the baby. E. coli, Listeria monocytogenes. Okay, infants and children. Again, Haemophilus influenzae type B, because that really occurs anywhere from 0 to 6 years, so that fits in both categories. Neisseria meningitidis has primarily two age ranges that we talked about. One of these was 6 to 12 months. This one usually does not affect neonates up here. We don't see it here because mom has circulating antibodies to Neisseria meningitidis oftentimes before passed on to the baby. So about 6 months, 4 to 6 months or so, is when mom's antibodies start to deteriorate, the baby's immune system has to take over. That's when they're most vulnerable. And then adults, strep pneumoniae, particularly in elderly and immunocompromised, maybe it starts out as a pneumonia, and the pneumonia then can spread into or develop into meningitis, which is oftentimes at that point lethal or fatal in the adult. And then meningitis in the young adult age group, your age group. And again, usually, well, you can track that by droplets, contaminated droplets and aerosols, things, but it usually is found. You see outbreaks. When you see an outbreak of meningitis, it's usually Neisseria meningitidis. And it's usually among people that are living in closer quarters, like we mentioned, the military barracks, dormitories. So that's a list of why it's easier for the doc to prescribe empiric therapy, because they know pretty much which organisms to expect during which age group. Okay, so why are infants or neonates so prone or so susceptible to developing meningitis? Well, there's three main reasons. Premature rupture of the membranes. Okay, this would be during pregnancy. If the placental membranes rupture prematurely, then organisms that are in mom's system can spread more readily to the fetus. Degree of maternal colonization, so it depends on how much infection mom has. And again, that's why we do the strep A galactia. And premature birth. So birth less than 37 weeks is considered, 37 weeks gestation is considered a premature birth. And what's happening here probably is the baby is exposed to lower levels. The baby is in the placental sac for a shorter period of time, which means they are not exposed to mom's antibodies long enough. So they have a shorter duration of maternal antibody, and therefore they have a lower level of maternal antibody. And that predisposes them to develop meningitis. So those are three main reasons why the neonate is more susceptible. Also, in addition, I should say, the organisms, you notice the organisms that we talked about, many of them inhabit the upper respiratory tract. Not so much in the fetus yet, because the fetus is sterile at birth, but after that, after the baby's born, these organisms will colonize the upper respiratory tract, and then, as we saw, it's a very short anatomical distance between the upper respiratory tract and the nasopharynx and the meninges. Okay, so that's another reason. Another reason is many of these organisms are encapsulated. They have capsules. We've talked about this before. The infant, the neonate, very young, does not have antibody development yet. The antibodies that are needed, well, we call them the opsonins. Remember opsonins? Antibodies that bind to capsules. And what does that do? That facilitates phagocytosis, because those antibodies that act as opsonins can bind to the organism. And then their FAB region, the monocyte, the phagocyte, has a receptor for that region to bind more readily to it. So the infants and neonates don't have those types of antibodies yet, so it's mostly the encapsulated organisms that you see that are causing the disease. Extracellular proliferation, they're not intracellular organisms, they're extracellular pathogens. Okay, now let's kind of correlate why it's important to do, or what do we do with the data that we get, because if the spinal fluid is sent to chemistry, it's sent to micro, and it's sent to hematology. So how do we put all these data together to help us determine whether or not they have meningitis and what type of meningitis? Okay, you don't have to memorize all these numbers. There's only one that you don't have to memorize. Okay, so normal spinal fluid. Okay, you've studied fluids in hematology, you studied spinal fluid in hematology. Okay, so you already know this. There's very few white blood cells. Those that are there are just able to kind of squeeze through, but usually they used to think there were absolutely no white cells, and the presence of any white cell was abnormal, but now up to 5. They're usually lymphocytes, monocytes. Oldies, what is the reference range for blood glucose? 70 to 100 milligrams per deciliter, approximately. So the spinal fluid glucose it should be upwards of 60%. This is percent of blood, not milligrams per deciliter. So it's about 60% or more of blood glucose. And oldies, what is the reference range for protein in spinal fluid? 15 to 45 milligrams per deciliter. Okay, this one just tells us that it's below 30, but we usually use that 15 to 45 milligrams per deciliter. Okay, now bacterial. So what do we see in bacterial meningitis then? A lot of white cells, greater than 1,000, so very high elevation of white cells, and they are usually neutrophils. Okay, blood glucose, is this decreased? Blood glucose is decreased. Why is blood glucose decreased?
Bacteria.
Right, these are extracellular bacteria. So they're showing their entities, people, as Christina would call them, I guess. So they're gobbling up the glucose. They're consuming the glucose. So the glucose is going to be decreased. And what about protein? That's increased. And that's increased probably because the inflammation of the blood-brain barrier makes it more permeable. So the protein passes from the blood into the spinal fluid. So it's not that the spinal fluid is making more. Usually the spinal fluid only synthesizes IgG in certain cases, but it passes across there and increases. Yeah.
Does that inflammation, is that also why you get so many neutrophils? Because they're able to pass by.
Probably. Yeah. Okay, so that's important. That's helpful information to put all that together to figure out what we're going to do is just differentiate bacterial and viral. We're not going to worry about fungal or tuberculosis. So viral, the white count is elevated, but not nearly as great as in bacterial. It's usually less than 100 in the most of lymphocytes. So the count and the type of white blood cells is important in differentiating. Glucose is normal. Why is it normal? Because viruses are intracellular, so they're not consuming the glucose that is there. And the total protein, this says 30 to 80, so we'll just kind of say normal, could be normal, or it could be increased. Okay, and then again, the rest of them we're not going to worry about. So you don't have to memorize these numbers. Just know that in bacterial, the white count is much greater than in viral. It's usually neutrophils versus lymphs. Glucose is low, protein is elevated. So that's why all of this information is important to help the doc determine what we're dealing with here. Okay, this is empiric therapy. And, once again, you do not have to memorize antibiotics. This is just to kind of show you a guide as to what the doc might be looking at, depending upon the age group of the patient. So, penicillin is used here. Penicillin is still good therapy for, even though a lot of organisms are resistant, Strep agalactia is not real resistant to penicillin. Neisseria meningitidis is not really resistant, so penicillin is the choice, drug of choice for Neisseria meningitidis. And these others, ceftriaxone, cefotaxime, these are cephalosporins, so they're newer type drugs that are used. So that's kind of a guide to what they use. And then you can see here, after they've determined what the organism is, the therapy might change a little bit, but it's really not going to change a whole lot. So they can get started very early, initiating the therapy, and it's probably going to be effective if they use one of those types of drugs. Okay, everybody awake? That's
a lot of cats.
My house is beginning to look like that.
Like a cat hotel.
Yeah. I wonder how they got them all in there and settled down.
Blue.
Blue? we still have not our kittens yet. So I'll make a big announcement. You'll be the first to know. I'll take pictures. Okay, here we go. Case study. 22-year-old woman was admitted to the hospital because of an acute onset of headache, fever, stiff neck. What's another name for stiff neck?
Mucorigidity.
Okay, see, you can introduce into conversation. That's very easy to do. Yes, it is. Yeah, I'll come with the scripture on Monday.
Okay.
And photophobia. Physical findings included a fever of 103. Is that elevated?
Yeah.
Pain upon flexion of the neck. Okay, one thing I didn't mention is the membranes, the meninges, when they become inflamed, it becomes very painful. That's where a lot of the pain comes from, probably the headache too, in addition to the swelling. So for them to flex their neck or turn their hip, that's very painful because of the meninges. And I once asked a doc, when they have a neonate or an infant, you know, 3 months of age or so, how do they know if they have a stiff neck? And what he said was they just hold them in their hands, so their little butt is here, and their little head here, and they just kind of twist the hip. And they can feel that it's very, very stiff. I mean, oh, I shouldn't say very, very stiff, but they can tell by just moving the head around that it's stiff, stiffer than normal. And so that's how they tell in an infant whether they've got the stiff neck or the meninges are inflamed somewhat. And tender maxillary sinuses. Examination of the ears revealed no evidence of otitis. The remainder of the exam was normal. Doctor diagnosed ALL when she was 4. And she had successful chemotherapy and ready to complete remission. She had no pets at home. However, field mouse was seen occasionally in the kitchen. She needs a cat. Okay. Let's see. What's the possible diagnosis?
Nice
serious. No.
That's
just the diagnosis. Meningitis.
Encephalitis.
Is that possible?
Okay.
Yeah. Symptoms are very similar. What else? What type of meningitis? Not organism.
Subacute.
Most likely subacute. Anything else? Okay, so bacterial meningitis, what about aseptic meningitis? So what's aseptic meningitis? Viral. Could it be viral? Same type of symptoms?
Yeah, sure.
Could be encephalitis. Okay, so it could be any of those. Just from those symptoms that we're given. Okay, what kind of sample do we want? Spinal fluid. Good. Okay. What are we going to do with it? How are we going to process it?
Immediate.
Okay, staff procedure. Stat usually means we have an hour turnaround time, by the time we receive the sample in the lab to the time we give our presumptive report or preliminary report. Is it all? That's just general. Okay, so how are we going to process it?
Well, you record them to the
okay, good. So,
it's
if it's cloudy, you're grasping it immediately. Okay, then what? It's not cloudy, we don't have to gram stain immediately, so either way, whether it's clear or cloudy, we centrifuge. Okay, then what?
Can you take off the supernatant and save it?
Save the supernatant.
And just take the stuff from the pellet, the SPA, chocolate?
What do we have to do first? Before
mix
we put
it
on?
Mix
it? How do we mix it? Vortex. You want to get it mixed really well so that those organisms are not trapped within little bits and pieces of the sediment. Okay, mix it well. How much do we put on the media?
One drop.
What media are we going to use?
SBA, CA, and TSB.
Okay, and TSB if the lab uses that. That they may not use that, but SBA and chocolate. So can we grow everything that we're going to find pretty much on SBA and chocolate?
Yes.
Neisseria?
Yes.
Haemophilus?
Yes.
Listeria?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, now what tests are performed? If the doc sends the sample to hematology, micro, and chemistry, what are we going to do?
Cell count.
Cell count differential in hematology. What about chemistry?
Protein.
Those protein. And then there may be others that they request, but at a minimum, they'll do those. And then micro? Gram stain culture. Okay, so glucose protein, white blood cell, differential, gram stain culture. Okay. This is what was found. Okay, glucose, 19. Protein, 289. Elevated white count, 88% lymphs, or PMNs. So, now what do you think is a possible
bacteria.
Bacterial meningitis. See how easy that was?
Yes.
You guys don't need to go to medical school.
Enough.
Okay, what do you want to know next?
Microbial bacteria.
Gram
stain? Yes.
Many PMNs? What do you think? But no organisms.
Oh.
Was that the initial gram stain or the
gram stain after it's put in?
You know, both ways.
But it's not from the culture. Both ways.
It's from the fluid, from the spinal fluid. Okay, what do you want to know next?
What's there anything early?
Chocolate.
Wow.
Okay, we've got how many types? Colony types?
Three.
We've got these grayish ones here. We've got the white ones. Some little ones. What could these white ones possibly be? The white ones.
Oh.
White ones most likely are staph epidermidis. Because staph epidermidis is usually white, and that can be contaminated. Or skin isn't scrupulously clean. Okay, the ones that are of most interest, I would say, are these grayish ones around in here. There's one over there. Okay, let's see. So we've got a lot of growth. Why were no organisms seen on the gram stain?
The gram stain is only sensitive to.
What's the sensitivity?
10%.
We've had at least 10 to 50 organisms in the spinal fluid or in whatever we're gram staining in order to see it. So that's, you have to understand that when you're surprised, you think, well, there's no organisms here, so it must not be bacterial. But you have to realize the sensitivity of gram stain. What additional stain can we do besides gram stain?
It's
more sensitive. What's it called? Zeal Nielsen? He says no. That's for tuberculosis.
Yeah.
We don't do the Zeal Nielsen. Not yet, not unless the doc requests it. So what's the fluorescent one called?
India.
No.
Peter.
Just spent med school.
Acridine orange, yeah.
Acridine orange, right. Acridine orange. All right. What do you want to know next? Or what do you... Oh, that's what it says. What do you want to know next? Right. Okay, that's what the Gram State from the colony looked like. The grayish colony on chocolate. Gram negative?
Negative.
So, possibilities are?
Hemophilus?
Let me go back here. If you look real closely, it's kind of hard to see, but they look mostly like tiny rods. I don't really see a lot of predominant diplococci. The Neisseria should be bigger and more diplococci, kidney bean shaped, right? And these look more like the rods, the individual ones. So if you look, you can. It's hard to capture that in this, but it looks more like Haemophilus. But
I thought Haemophilus was traditionally filamentous.
No. Haemophilus influenza can be filamentous, but it doesn't have to be. But you do look for those filaments if you see them. That's helpful, but it doesn't have to be. Okay, now what? What do we do before X and B?
Catalase and oxidase.
Okay, should we do an oxidase?
Sure.
Should we do catalase? Okay, now what?
X and B.
Now you want to do the X and B. Okay. Is that X and B positive?
Yes.
Okay. So now what's the most likely pathogen then? Haemophilus influenzae. Okay, so that would rule out Neisseria. Neisseria was a possibility there. Okay, now, any additional testing that could be done? The plot thickens. Antigen testing. Okay, we talked about Haemophilus influenzae type B. That's where the vaccine comes from, the HIB vaccines, Haemophilus influenzae type B. So we want to know if it's type B, so we do antigen testing, this serological testing for that antigen. But it was negative. Quelling reaction. Possibility. That's an older test. What's the quelling reaction?
Capsular
swelling. Is it specific for Haemophilus?
No, specific for capsules.
For capsules. Okay, so why was the antigen testing negative? If we cultured Haemophilus influenzae, why was it negative? It was not serotype B. That's right. Okay, so there are other serotypes. There's type C, there's other serotypes that can cause it. So when you see discrepancies like this, you have to think about what's happening here and why. Do I have a discrepancy? And if I do, why? Bill's going to talk to you a lot about discrepancies. Okay, so. What was the predisposing event? Why did the patient get meningitis? Let's go back to our case study. See if you can find anything in there that tells you.
The mouse.
I think the mouse is just a red herring.
Yeah.
It's not really a mouse, it's a dead fish.
She had no pets.
She had no what?
Pets.
She had no pets, is that why she got meningitis? Mm-hmm. That's what I say. She had a cat, she'd be immune. She had four cats, she'd be quadruple immune. So you can't find anything in there? Tender maxillary sinuses. Okay, so if you have, if a patient maybe has chronic sinusitis or sinus infection or something, tender maxillary sinuses is what she had. And so the meningitis was due to chronic sinusitis. They did a CAT scan, and it revealed a small meningeal tear behind the sinuses. So again, because of the close anatomy there, it just took a little tear, and the organism from the sinuses, or the upper respiratory tract, sinuses, was able to get through there and cause meningitis. She treated with ampicillin. She was fine, and the next day she went out and bought a cat. Okay, that's it. Let's go see what grew.
Okay.
So,
where would you go?
No.